That's right. We're back with another Dog Days of Summer edition of the Always Irish Notre Dame Football Podcast channel. I am coming to you. This is Sunday evening. Usually I record on Mondays, but there's too much rattling around in my head, and I've been talking to a few people this afternoon, and I just said that the hell with it, I'm going to go in and record. So if any news breaks Monday, it's not going to be on this show. I'm recording Sunday night, so we want to get that out of the way first. And let's do the propers and then get into this. We got a lot to cover, some of it good, some of it bad, some of it just bad luck. Obviously, you could find me, Always Irish is the YouTube channel. Always Irish on Twitter or at JKZND4. You will find me there as well. We are accessible. iTunes is taking off. A lot of people like that medium. Roll with it. It's easy. Google Play, Stitcher as well. Like, share, review, subscribe. All that stuff helps grow the channel and helps me bring more content. So I do appreciate you guys doing that. And so here's where we need to go. First things first, before we get into actual Notre Dame talk, rest in peace to Cedric Benson, 36 years old, and he spent some time with the Bears and the Bengals, and he passed away in a motorcycle accident, I believe, late last night in Texas, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, Ced had a complicated run here in Chicago. It just didn't go smoothly. I don't think he was ever fully comfortable or happy here. And it's weird. There was a period of time where Ced was dating or seeing or, you know, I don't know the exact details, but he was connected with a female friend of mine. And she and I were very close. And as a result of that, while they were seeing each other, I ended up getting to go to a bunch of games with Ced's tickets, and then we would go out at, these were home games, and then we would go out after the game, and he would meet up with us for dinner somewhere in the city. And so I had an interesting little run of having dinners with Ced Benson, and kind of quiet, kind of unassuming, kind of shy almost when I was around him. He didn't have much to say. And so he just had a really complicated tenure in Chicago, and this is just a shame. It sounds like it was just a horrible motorcycle accident. I don't know any details, but, you know, rest in peace to Ced, and, you know, thoughts are with his family and friends. So I wanted to get that out of the way. And so while we're talking about things that aren't ideal and not great, I mean, I'm not trying to compare the next topic to Cedric Benson passing away. I'm not trying to do that. Don't get it twisted. But Michael Young's got a cracked collarbone just like Cole Kmet does. And I put on Twitter, I was just joking, collarbone crack you? Like I don't... Listen, it's not ideal. It sounds like he's got the exact same thing Cole Kmet had, and it happened almost the exact same way. Him trying to make a great acrobatic play, coming down weird, landed on that shoulder, pop, boom, there it goes. Okay? And so here's the really disappointing part with this is, coming into the spring and then early in practice, it was like, oh, Cole Kmet's looking great. He's ready to take the next step. Notre Dame's going to start using these tight ends as a weapon in the passing game again. I get all excited about that. Boom, Cole Kmet goes down. There goes that plan. Okay, everything they have planned with the tight ends is going to be scaled back until he gets back. It just is. The other two guys aren't that far along, and they don't want to run two tight end sets in case somebody else gets hurt, because now we're thin at that position. So that already messes up what I wanted them to do at tight end to start the year. Then, so all I heard was about how, what a great start Cole Kmet was off to, then boom, now he goes down. The next thing I heard, and I was really excited about, was people started saying what a standout fall session Michael Young's having. They're saying that he's not outplaying, but is showing these flashes among the receivers that are far and above even Fink and Claypool. That he's all over the place, he's athletic, he's fast, he's making acrobatic catches, all this kind of stuff. So then I start thinking, Well, this is great. Now we really got something going with these receivers now. Because you know what you're going to get out of Claypool and Fink. Now you add Michael Young in there. And then you have Lawrence Keys and Lindsey behind him. And then hopefully Smokey Robinson whenever he gets out of Brian Kelly's doghouse. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But and then you add him in there. And then we got something going. And so now all of that optimism is scrapped. And I've been kind of saying, like, with Kmet, like, I was hopeful, you know, this would be some quick turnaround recovery. You know, you're going to miss a couple weeks against nobody's early in the year. And then, you have the bye in between there. You know, so that gains you an extra month of prep time to get ready for Georgia. I don't think either of these guys are going to be ready for Georgia. I don't think it's possible physically. And so that's incredibly disappointing. And it's just bad luck. But here's a couple things. It's like I got people on Twitter saying, John, you need to calm down about this. Like every team has injuries in camp. Fine. I acknowledge that. But that this is my team, so forgive me that I'm going to be mad when it happens to our good players. So that is that supposed to make me feel better? And here's the other thing, too. You can say all you want, oh, every team has stuff happen like this. Not every single team is going to be banged up to the exact amount as the other team. So don't act like it's totally even. Some teams are going to get lucky and get out unscathed. They're the only guys that get hurt or third stringers or something. So don't act like it's automatic that every team's going to have two frontline starters go down on offense. Don't tell me just to expect that and calm down because of that, because it ain't going to happen. So yeah, I know people get banged up, but I'm still going to bitch about it. So just let me do it. Excuse me that two of the guys I was most excited to see that are getting pumped up and hyped up are now injured for a quarter of the season. Am I not allowed to be upset about that? Come on. So, no, I'm not going to calm down. This is upsetting. It's a setback. The offense is not going to be operating at peak efficiency. It affects your depth, and I don't like it. So don't tell me online, oh, other teams have injuries too. Just chill out. I don't care about these other teams. I care about my team. And now our two biggest weapons have gone down. So, that being said, it's just, here's the other part of this. What do you want to do about this? Tell these guys in practice not to go hard and try hard and not to go up and make plays they can make? Like, this is just, shit happens. But I'm not going to tell these guys to scale down or what are you going to really tell them? They shouldn't go up to make a great catch in practice. That's what you want us to tell our guys? Come on, that's just not going to happen. It's just pure bad luck. That's all it is stupid, dumb, bad luck. But to say I'm annoyed by this would be a severe understatement. We already went over what's going to happen at tight end. That whole dream plan of two tight end sets and Cole Kmet up the seam, opening everything up, forget it. That's going to be gone down the toilet till he comes back. They're just not going to run it the same way with Brock Wright and Tommy Tremble. They're just not. They might run some of it, but it isn't going to be what I wanted, the full package that opens everything up. Then, when you look at the receiver situation, here's what's going to happen. You're going to slide Fink outside, and then you're going to slide Lawrence Keys into the slot. Now, that's fine. Listen, it's like, John, we got all these guys. Don't worry about it. I'm still worried about it. I know Lawrence Keys is fast, but I felt really good about him being the fourth guy, knowing I had Michael Young stepping up, who I wasn't necessarily expecting him to this extent, to get hyped up as much as he's been by all these practice reports. So yeah, I'm excited about Lawrence Keys. I was a lot more excited about him as a fourth option, not a required third option. Okay, now all your depth is getting affected here. So I don't love that, but that's what the plan is. So Fink's going to move to the outside, Keys back into the slot. And then the other thing is, you know, even in that scrimmage they did Saturday, Kevin Austin got no reps. So he's still in Brian Kelly's doghouse. I get it. Okay, I understand the violation, whatever. Jeez, I mean, that it's borderline medicine now in this country. So get him out of the doghouse and send him down to play the dogs in Georgia. Seriously, it's medication. So I'm sorry if I'm agitated tonight, but some of this stuff's getting on my damn last nerve. So fine, he's in the doghouse, been getting dragged through the mud, everybody talking about him in trouble. Okay, how long is this going to go on for? Bench him for the first 2 weeks, let him come back hungry, and go down there and make plays against Georgia. Come on, let's go. And so what that means is everybody steps up a notch. Lawrence Keys, welcome to the starting lineup. Braden Lindsey, you're next in line, bud. So everybody better get ready here. You know, geez, we're only a couple weeks into camp. We're going to have half an offense if this injury rate continues. I'm sorry that I don't have patience for that. That's frustrating to me. I'm sorry. That's not going to change. It's not ideal. Now, these injuries are coming from these guys playing their asses off in practice and competing hard. And that leads me into my next big point here. Now, last week, you guys are going to think I'm maybe crazy for this. I'm stepping out and I'm going to say something here that I don't think a lot of people would expect from me, especially this time in the season. For me to announce a stance like I'm going to announce. But it's something I've been thinking about since the beginning of this camp, reading all the camp reports, seeing what little clips, video clips there are available to us online, through Twitter or whatever, and just reading and listening to what everybody that does have access has been seeing. And this ties into the big picture with Brian Kelly in Notre Dame. And one of my biggest complaints about Brian Kelly in Notre Dame, and I finally think I've seen enough that I'm willing to kind of put myself out there and make the following edict. Well, not an edict. I don't know what you call it. Just putting this out there is a little uncomfortable for me, but I honestly, genuinely feel this. And you guys know me. I wouldn't say it if I didn't. And here's what it is. One of my biggest complaints about Notre Dame and Brian Kelly, especially through some of these unnecessarily poor years, was about culture. And I've done a lot of shows mad about Notre Dame's culture and how do we make it a more competitive vibe? How do we ramp up the intensity? How do we have guys dogfighting for plays? And the hardest thing about saying we need a better culture is, well, how do you define culture, right? It's not like, hey, we need more rushing yards. We need to improve offensive line play. And there's tangible marks of how you're doing to reach that goal. When you talk about establishing and setting a championship culture, it's a lot harder to define. It's a lot harder to identify what needs to happen to get there. And there's been years under this Brian Kelly thing where I just didn't feel that vibe was where it needed to be. And it was really frustrating. And I felt like Kelly was frustrated and it just didn't feel whole. I don't know how else to put it. This year, I have to say, from all accounts of what I've seen, heard, read, and listened to, I don't think that's a problem this year. And that's hard for me to say as usually the glass half empty Notre Dame guy. But what I see is, I see a ratcheted up intensity from the beginning of this camp I don't usually see. I see guys dogfighting to make plays out there. I see the players pushing other players and holding them accountable without the staff having to do so. And coinciding with that, I think it's no coincidence that we're seeing a different version of Brian Kelly. And I think these things go hand in hand. And I think a big part of it is I think Brian Kelly is finally comfortable with his staff. I think that's a big part of it. I think he trusts the guys around him to not only run their position groups efficiently and well, but to also be good recruiters that he could trust to pull their weight. And I don't think he's had that kind of stability or comfort before. So I think all these things have kind of combined to put Brian Kelly in a really, really comfortable place. That's the way I would describe Brian Kelly right now. He seems to be comfortable with where he's at in terms of his demeanor to the team, in terms of his demeanor with the media. He's a totally different guy than he was even a few years ago. More laid back. He's joking. He's walking that line between purple face and player's best friend. Like, he's found a middle ground there with which to operate. And I think all these things are kind of combining. Now, when you ask yourself what caused that, well, I think you had a couple years here of 10 plus wins where you were highly competitive in the national picture. And I think that's ultra important, because what that does is that creates a level of expectation. So then as these guys mature through the program years 2, 3, 4, 5, and they've been around these teams that are winning 10 or 12 games, that becomes the expectation. That becomes the minimal acceptable outcome. And that is the tide that rises all ships. And to me, all ships is all the players and all the position groups. And so that's what I feel. This is just my vibe. Now, if you go out and lose 30-0 to Georgia, then I don't care what your vibe is. You got problems again. So, this could change. I'm just telling you what I honestly, genuinely feel, that it's possible we're turning the corner to get into that winning culture a little bit more the way I want it, to see that intensity, see guys giving 100% in practice, see guys fighting for playing time, seeing other players hold other players accountable for practice performance, okay, to where the coaches don't have to get in there and do it. The upperclassmen are handling it. These are all indications of a healthy, high-level, winning, competitive culture. And I genuinely, honestly feel like the beginning of this practice session, we're in a good spot with that. And that's just my vibe. You guys could think something different. But that's just my vibe from what I gather. And I've just read multiple people saying they've been to these practices and they've never quite seen it so intense and so energetic and everybody just ready to go. And I think that's huge. I think that's key. And I think it's all part of the same ball of wax with Brian Kelly finding a comfortable spot for him to operate with his personality, with the players and the media. And I think he's in a good spot. He trusts his staff. He's got a good staff around him. And he's got players in the program that are used to winning at a high level now. Now, yeah, they're not at the ultra elite level. I know they're not. That's what they're trying to get. Establishing this kind of winning culture early in the summer is a good first step to that. And so for me, the usual, glass half empty Notre Dame guy, I think this is really saying something, that I, of all people, genuinely feel this enough to put it on record and mention it. But I just do. I don't think we're totally there yet. But I feel like we're getting there. I feel like that culture's changing a little bit in the direction I wanted it to. And so I'm encouraged by this. But the thing is with this, this team plays and practices with a little bit of swag now. They're bouncing around with a chip on their shoulder. I love that. But you got to back it up. That's the second part of this. And that's the part I don't have answers yet too. But you got to back it up. And so that's the second part of this. I don't have the answers to that yet. But as far as the attitude, the effort level, the intensity, the competition and practice, right now I couldn't ask for more. And it's where I want it to be. And it's indicative of a high-level program with high-level expectations of the season. Now you just got to go do something. And mostly what I would like you to do is go into Athens and do something nobody's picking you to do, and show up and play them tough and find a way to scrap out a win the same way they did when they came to visit you. See, that's the thing about Georgia. It's a ton of talent, but they're in a similar spot to Notre Dame. Georgia's not over the hump yet either. They haven't quite been able to win the biggest of biggest games, and they've blown some big leads and had some heartbreaks. So they're still trying to learn how to crack into that ultra elite group too. They have an athletic roster that could definitely put them there, you know, but they haven't quite won to that level either yet. And so there's no reason to think Notre Dame doesn't have a chance, if they play an efficient, tight ball game, to be competitive in that contest. You got to play good ball, though. You can't go in there and shit your pants because of the environment like you did in Miami. And you can't go in there and kick the ball around and fumble it or do anything stupid. You're going to have to play an ultra-efficient game for you to have a chance. But I don't see why with Ian Book at quarterback, why there should be any question that we could do that. So what we need to look for is how this is going to translate on the field. Like I said, if you go into Louisville and kick the ball around, you know, and barely win or something, then we got time to reevaluate my position on this. But from what I see so far, they seem ready, and I'm encouraged by that. Moving forward, something else I've been reading about these scrimmages and stuff, it seems like the offensive and defensive lines have kind of traded off winning the days. And I was trying to think of if that's good or bad, and I think it probably is good. Because I think if one was dominating the other consistently, that would probably be a red flag. But given that we expect a lot out of both of these lines this year, it doesn't surprise me to see that they're rotating good days and getting the best of one another, and I'm totally fine with that. You know, the other thing to keep in mind, we were talking about ways to kind of neutralize our undersized interior defensive line when you go down to Athens. And I think one way they're going to do that is they're going to do some tricky stuff. I think they know they're going to have to, and they're going to move some of those DNs inside in certain situations. They're going to do some unique stuff to try and cover that up, which is exactly what I want to see. I'm totally fine doing it. There's some risk involved there. I'm fine with it, because I just think it's going to be needed for you to stay in this game with Georgia, not let them pound the rock down your throat, which is what they're going to want to do first and foremost. So I'm fine with the offensive and defensive lines, you know, pushing each other back and forth. And one day this group wins, the next day the other group wins. I'm okay with that. I think that's healthy for this time of the year. And I'd kind of be alarmed if it was lopsided all the way one way or all the way the other. So I'm fine with this. And here's something else I was thinking about. And hear me out on this, because philosophically, I think this makes a lot of sense in my mind philosophically. I'm going to throw it out to you guys. Let me know if it makes sense to you. But when you want to talk about this running back position with Tony Jones and Jafar and Sebo and Kyren Williams and Jameer Smith, and there's all this question about who's going to fill what role and who's going to be out there when, who's going to get the bulk of these carries, what's going to happen, is that a weakness on this team? You know, the more the weeks go by, the less, I don't want to say concerned, but like the less I'm worried about the running backs. And here's why. Unlike, say, like a cornerback position or a safety, like you have to look at worst case outcomes when you have depth concerns or questions. So what I mean by that is the worst case scenario, if you have bad depth at cornerback or safety, is a touchdown. We saw it against Clemson. That's your worst case scenario. You don't have a guy you could play, whether it's due to injury, he's dragging his arm around or whatever the reason is. The worst case scenario is they throw a ball and our guy isn't there and it's a touchdown and you just killed momentum and you just gave him 7 points. Flip that over to running back. Okay, it's just less traumatic. And what I mean by that is, I don't think any of these guys have Dexter Williams speed. They just don't. Kyren Williams is fast, but I still don't think he's Dexter Williams. And he's young, and I'm not sure he's going to get that much carries anyways this year. But here's how I look at it. Worst case scenario in the secondary is you give up a big play and a touchdown, and it kills all momentum and shifts it. Worst case scenario for the running backs, let's assume they can all hold on to the ball, obviously, okay? And they're not, you know, butterfingers turning it over 80 times fumbling. Let's count that out. Let's give them some surface level credibility here. If the worst case scenario is a hole that would have been a 40-yard run for a first down or a touchdown for Dexter Williams turns out to be a 12-yard run for a first down for one of these guys, I can live with that. That's still a positive play. Yeah, it's not Dexter Williams making one cut and going 98 yards against Virginia Tech to open up the game and shut that stupid crowd up. It's not that. But if the worst case scenario is an 8 or 12 yard run up the gut for a first down, are any Notre Dame fans going to complain with that? Like if that's the low end output, I can deal with that. Where on the back end of the defense, one mistake's a touchdown you're giving up could cost you the game. This way, it's still a first down. It's still a positive play. So even if your running backs don't have that speed, the bottom end isn't quite as traumatic. They're just not going to break it as far as Dexter did or Josh Adams did, but it's still going to be a positive play. If there's a hole there, they're still going to hit it. Just isn't going to be as fast and for as many yards. And so the longer we get through this, the less kind of concerned I am with that position, I guess. I hope that makes sense philosophically. I just think there's other positions where that uncertainty would scare me a lot more because the worst case outcome's a lot worse. Moving on to those linebackers, you knew that was going to be an ongoing situation to monitor. Owusu-Koramoah, you already know that, okay? He's got that Rover position, you know, locked up. We're comfortable with that. It seems to me at the other two positions, there's still a lot of mixing and matching with different guys. Asmer Bilal's been switching between both positions, okay, inside. So here's what I think they're going to end up doing. I think you're going to end up with these guys mixing and matching based on the situation and the yardage and the down. That's what I think we need to expect. I don't think you have the guys that are just going to be the starters and play three downs and get off the field at those other two spots. So I think what you're looking at is you're going to have some guys that are in there when it's more early run type downs. And then you're going to have guys switched out when it's longer downs or a passing third down situation. You're going to have some guys swapped out that are longer, lankier, could cover more ground. And that's going to be more their expertise. And so that's kind of the writing on the wall from what I see and read from practice and from the scrimmage Saturday. And so, yeah, I'm still freaked out. I'm still uncomfortable. It's still big time unknowns. But if that is what it is, and they're going to piece this together package by package, down by down, situation by situation, do what you need to do. And I'm fine testing this out. And I just hope you learn what you need to learn from Louisville and New Mexico so that any changes that to those roles can be made when we go to Georgia so that we're not putting guys out there who are not going to be able to use their skill set for the situation in front of them. So I think this is just going to be a mix and match. Down and distance, situational, rotational type deal, unless somebody really does emerge and then you just can't take them off the field. But right now, that's what it looks like. Now, what concerns you with that is, you know, a lot of teams are going to, on offense, are going to take some time to sub in on obvious third down passing situations, and that will allow Notre Dame to have time to get their package in they want for that too. But if a team goes up tempo on you and tries to do all that, and your guys are stuck on the field, that's what makes me nervous. Because then you have guys stuck out there that aren't in their comfort zone, and teams are going to try and take advantage of that. So it's still not an ideal situation. I'm still uncomfortable. I would always prefer just established guys. You know what you're going to get. That's just not our situation. So the best thing you could do is hope that the staff is good enough evaluators to know who can play what, when, and where, and to test this out against two inferior opponents the first two games and figure it out. Because Georgia's not the week to have guys out there running around with their heads cut off, confused. I have no patience for it. This is like year 10 of Brian Kelly. You can't have guys running around out there that don't know what they're doing. Especially down in Athens. You can't give up a cheap score because some guy doesn't know where he's supposed to be. So they better damn well figure it out now. So that being said, now I want to talk about something positive because a lot of this has been kind of rough. Not the culture thing, but the actual stuff with the players. I haven't had a lot of good news today. But Hamilton continues to impress. He just keeps making interceptions. He's just all over the field. And they are not going to be able to take him off the field. And people thought maybe, like, you know, he had a good couple days with a handful of interceptions that would eventually slow down or stagnate or the offense would get sharper. It's not happening. The kid's making plays every single opportunity. And the reason this is important is twofold. One, it gives you some options and flexibility at the safety position that I don't think that we could rely on going into this spring and summer fall session, because he wasn't an early enrollee. He wasn't there. We didn't know what we had, and we knew what he was supposed to be. But we didn't know till this camp started it was going to be like this. The kid's been absolutely unbelievable, not overwhelmed, has a knack for the ball. He's an athletic freak. He's 6'4", faster than hell, covers a ton of ground, catches everything. I've heard that if it's anywhere near him, he catches it. I love it. So this is good for this year in terms of safety depth. I mean, Aloe Gilman and Jaylen Elliott can't play every single snap. Those guys are going to need some help. So that's good. But the other reason is having a young guy that's going to play early, that's going to be the future leader of these teams. He's going to be a guy that can assume that leadership role in a couple years, take over this secondary, and be the captain, leading by example. I love that. The other thing I love is, like we talked about after the Clemson game, and we just talked about how a lot of us getting beat that bad to Clemson was just because they had stars making plays. And having a guy that's this young, we need more of that. And so even if it's just one guy a year, that's a start. Like on defense. Like, let's say Kyron Williams is that guy and he ends up finding a niche role in this offense. And then you have Hamilton in the secondary on defense. That's an improvement for Notre Dame. This isn't Clemson, Georgia, Ohio State, Alabama, where they got a handful of five-star freshmen that make plays right away. That's just not the realistic world that Notre Dame lives in and exists in currently. So you got to have baby steps, and that's what I've been asking for. And if the best I can get is one of those guys on each side of the ball moving forward, I think I can live with that, because it's still better than what we've had, where these guys that get all this hype sit around for 2 or 3 years in the program on the practice field. So I think that's an encouraging development. We got to start somewhere. So if it can be Kyron Williams on offense, finding a role, whether it's catch and swing passes or he ends up getting actual carries behind center, whatever it is, I'm fine with that. And so that's why I think this is an important development. I've been saying Notre Dame needs more guys that surprise you and play early. That just adds to your overall depth and your options. And it's great. And so I like this. And it gives me some comfort. And the other thing is, looking at the 20 and 21 recruiting classes, I think there's going to be more kids that fit this mold that could come in and do that. And that just, again, that's the rising tide rises all ships. What does that do? You got a freshman coming in here. These upperclassmen are going to be scared they're losing their position, so they're going to try harder, right? Like, that competition is good and healthy for everybody. No upperclassman wants to come in there and have an 18-year-old freshman outplaying them and stealing their snaps. But that's what you need. That's a part of building that culture we talked about earlier. Guys that can come in there and compete early. So that's a great development, and I love it, and that's how I'm looking at it. If you could start out with one on each side of the ball, and then maybe one year have two, that's how you start to break into that more elite roster territory. We all know it's hard for Notre Dame to recruit and all that stuff. We're not going to get into that. Everybody knows why it's harder to recruit at Notre Dame. They have less margin for error. So getting kids like this is key, and it's a key factor and component to us getting to that next level. So I love it, love it, love it. I can't wait to see what this kid's going to turn into because it's exciting already. So find a role for him. Find a role for Kyren Williams. Let these young kids make plays. It makes everybody better, makes the program stronger. Now, I'm already losing hair just reading this bullet point on my outline here. Excuse me here, but what I've been told and what I've read says that Jonathan Dorr has started to come on a little stronger in practice and been more consistent. That's fine. Tell me that all you want. All I care about is under the bright lights, are you making the field goals or not? Again, shouldn't matter the first two games, but I got to know, here's why this is so important. I got to know whether I can trust you or not before we go to Georgia. If I can't trust you against Louisville, New Mexico, there's no way I'm trusting you down in Athens at night. It ain't happening. So I would rather know that early so that if we need to prepare for those third and fourth down situations when we cross the other team's 50, if we need to plan to have two plays to go for it on fourth down, I need to know that before Georgia. So he either needs to be lights out against Louisville, New Mexico, or he needs to be horrible. So I know one way or the other which way this is going to go before we go to Athens. I think the worst case scenario is for him to be like 50-50, make a few, miss a few, make a long one, miss a short one. Then you don't know what you have. And I've already heard the staff is prepared to take more chances on third and fourth down and go for it. I'm totally fine with that. I told you my philosophy on that. If it comes down to having to trust Dorr or Ian Book, I'm trusting Ian Book with two downs to get 6 yards. He's going to figure it out more times than not. It's not always going to work out, but I trust Ian Book's mind, arm, and legs a lot more than I do a kicker. I just do. So, fine. The reports are that he's coming on and has been better lately this last week. That's fine and dandy. Don't miss any against Louisville. Don't miss any against New Mexico. Then maybe I'll feel good going into Georgia. Just kidding. I'm not going to feel good because that's a totally different. I'm lying to myself now. Because even if they make them against Louisville and New Mexico, I'm going to say, yeah, but we were probably up by a bunch, and it's Louisville, New Mexico, not every eyeball in America on the TV watching you in Athens, Georgia, trying to get the biggest upset of the college football year. Okay? So this situation has me on edge. It has me anxiety riddled. It has my hairline falling out more than when I missed a 3-foot birdie putt on number one last week in golf league. Okay? So it's just an anxiety that I don't have patience for. It's a problem I don't think we should have, and I'm annoyed that we haven't. But that's where we stand. Figure it out. All right. Just to lighten it up here a little bit, before we get into the season, and there's not much room for any extras because we're going to actually have game stuff to go over, I wanted to cover this. It's something I was going back and forth on Twitter with some people with, and One Foot Down did an article about sitting versus standing for Notre Dame home games, and I think they actually interviewed like an usher and asked what the rules are. Do you get kicked out if you want to stand and the old guy behind you wants you to sit? And it actually kind of made me laugh. And there's a lot of different opinions on what's right or wrong in regards to this. My personal stance is one that I don't know how legitimate it is, because I'm afraid that I might just be a psychotic outlier. who's just neurotic and is on the fringe. And what I mean by that is, like, I'm that guy. If I'm not going to a Notre, if I'm not going to the game, I'm watching the game totally alone, locked in a room by myself. The dogs won't even stay with me because I yell and punch and kick stuff and scream, and they go and hide. Even the dogs won't stay with me. But I gotta be totally alone, or only with immediate family, because I know, I mean, they're the reason I'm like this, so they can't judge me for it. But I've been kicked out of my parents' house more than a few times for stuff that's happened during Notre Dame games. I admit that. I've been kicked out. I've been asked to leave by my mother, and I deserved it. I absolutely deserved it. What was it? A few years ago, I think it was Dane Crist fumbled a ball on like the half yard line against USC going in for a touchdown, and USC picked it up and ran it back 99 and a half yards for a touchdown at home against us. I'm pretty sure it was Dane Crist that did it. Fumbled it on like the half yard line. I was in the kitchen at my parents' house alone because they're all in the living room and I can't be with people. So even though I was with them, I was in the kitchen pacing around. When that happened, I lost control of my body. The nearest thing I found was a little thing of bananas on the island in the living room, in the kitchen. I grabbed the banana, drop kicked it. It exploded all over the ceiling. I lost control. I admit it. I didn't mean to do that. It was just an automatic reaction. I drop kicked the banana, exploded all over the ceiling, made this huge noise. I got asked to leave. I totally deserved it. Totally deserved it. But my point is that I don't sit down during Notre Dame games, whether I'm at the game or not. If I'm at home, I'm pacing around. I can't sit still. Okay, I'm walking back and forth, arms crossed, pacing, you know, whatever. That's just what I do. You will never find me watching a Notre Dame game at a bar or anywhere in public. That is a recipe for me to get arrested or killed. I can't handle it. I can't handle other people. I can't go to a bar where there's people, just there's people in your way. There's the other team's fans running their mouth. There's people there who don't care about the game and they're just in the way. I can't say what I want. I have to filter myself. There's no positives to that. I don't enjoy. Notre Dame football is not a group activity to me. That is not enjoyable. That is serious stuff. And it's not just, it's not ya-ya-ya-ha time. It's not social hour. It's just not for me. It's too damn important for me to be distracted by all this other stuff. I can't handle it. So how that translates is, for me to go to a home game at Notre Dame, it's actually pretty damn uncomfortable. I can't really be myself. Even if I'm in a section where standing isn't going to get me kicked out by all the old timers, I still can't really pace, and I definitely can't say what I want to say. So I automatically have to censor myself, and it's very, very uncomfortable. But I still do it when I can because I like being at Notre Dame. But it is hard and it is really uncomfortable. It's hard for me. But I do admit over the last handful of years, I feel like the home environment has improved. I feel like overall the crowd is louder than it was, say, 10 years ago. I mean, the Bush push was different. That's probably the loudest I've personally heard it. Stanford and Michigan in 2012 were pretty loud too. And look at what you had in line in each of those instances. I mean, everything was on the line. It was a big deal. But so overall, I do feel like the crowd experience has been better and a little bit louder the last handful of years than it has been before then. However, I resent the fact that there's always going to be a chunk of the Notre Dame fan base that looks at going to a Notre Dame home game as just a casual outing, just a casual gathering with friends, a sightseeing tour. I feel like it's like a museum tour or just a casual thing. And everybody, half the crowd just sits there on their hands and they're just there. I don't feel like these people care about the outcome. And that offends me. They're Notre Dame fans, but they're not like me. They're just not. And I can tell because I'm watching how they're acting during the game. Stand up when it's a big play. Yell when there's a bad call. Get into it. So I've always resented. There's just a big portion of that crowd. And you know what it is? It's the big money, cigar smoking, wine and cheese crowd. You know what I'm talking about. They're just there for the reunion with their buddies that they went to law school with. And they're happy to just sit there and enjoy a nice day in the fall. And whatever happens, happens. I'm there to see us win, damn it. All the social stuff that comes with it's just a benefit. I'm there to see them win. I'm not talking about being obnoxious and rude and screaming curse words with children around. I'm not talking about literally standing there the whole 7-hour NBC broadcast and blocking everybody's view. I'm talking about it's a big third down. Get your ass up. This is supposed to be a home environment that the rivals don't want to play in. It's a big third down. Everybody should be standing and yelling, okay? So, the thing that bothers me is, I look at some of these other home venues. I look at the Penn State. I look at Wisconsin. I look at Virginia Tech. I look at the Big House. And I see some of these places where it's just raucous the whole time. People are pumped up. Everybody's into it. Even the old people are into it. So people are like coming at me on Twitter. Well, John, some people are older and they can't stand. Why is there no old people going to Penn State home games? Is there no old people during Enter Sandman at Virginia Tech? We can't be the only fan base with older people in it. And why do I feel like at those other venues, it's just kind of known this is what we do. We stand up and we go crazy damn near the whole game. And so I get frustrated by this. I'm not saying I don't like this feeling like me saying I'm a better fan than these people. I just seem to care more about the outcome. I can't tell you how many home games I've left when we lost, and I'm kicking stuff down the road. I'm cursing the whole way out. You know what was a good example? Before the Bush push in 05, we lost to Michigan State in overtime, and they spiked the flag, and my dad and I were right there, right where they spiked the flag. I left that game so pissed off, and I ran into some people I grew up with on the way out. We just happened to run into them walking to our cars. And they were saying, oh, what a fun, exciting day. What a good back and forth game. This was so much fun. I can't relate to that. We lost in overtime to Michigan State and got disrespected at our home field. How am I supposed to feel good about that? This is just not how I live. There is no such thing as feeling good about that outcome. Not possible. So I'm not saying everybody has to be like me. I get it that football isn't the end-all be-all for everybody like it is me and my family. I get it. But what I do think those other people need to understand is you only get, what, 5, 6, maybe 7 home games a year to experience that. Out of those games, there's only a couple of them, maybe a year, that are big games at home, like with a big rivalry with something on the line. Those people need to understand that it's okay for other people to get excited, to get mad, to get jacked up, to be loud, to stand, to clap. This is not an opera. This is not a play. This is not going to listen to some speaker talk. So I'm sick of these people looking at me like I'm crazy when I'm yelling and standing, and they're acting like I'm the one doing something wrong. No, why don't you get up? I just don't get it. So many people go to these games that just apparently it's just not a big deal what happens in the game. It's just a social experience. That's the only conclusion I have. It's just something to do, but it's not heavily emotional to them apparently. And I just don't live that way. I don't go there for social hour. I go there to watch us win games. That's it. And so, no, I don't want to block the view of the 95-year-old World War, veteran who has loved Notre Dame for 70 years and can still get to the games. No, I'm not trying to be a jerk and block that old man's view. But damn it, it's a college football game at Notre Dame. I'm going to stand and I'm going to be loud. That should be encouraged, not discouraged. So there's no simple answer to this issue. There's just not. I almost wish there was some way they could have some sort of tiered seating to where if you really want to stand the whole time or have a more lively experience, there's a section kind of for people who want to do that. And if you need to be more in a family section, you have kids or old people that have to sit or have those needs, that they kind of steer you in a different direction. I almost wish we had that. You know, the best times I've had were either requesting or finding tickets at the very, very top row so I could stand and lean against the back and there I have no worries of anybody behind me to block, or being in the student section where you could stand the whole time. You don't need a seat number there. Everybody just stands. It's fine. So those are my preferences. But I there's no easy way to this solution. But when I look around the country, I see other fan bases who don't seem to have this issue nearly to the extent of Notre Dame. So to act like this is just happening everywhere, I disagree. I see all kinds of old people getting into it and standing damn near the whole game at some of these other stadiums. And if you don't think that energy helps the team, you're dead ass wrong. That team wants you to be fired up. So don't make me feel bad for doing it, because it ain't going to change. All right, I got a couple other notes, just really brief, like 1 minute tidbits. And a couple of them are NFL related too. I want to throw those in here before they get started with the regular season. And then we don't do much NFL here. So, but I wanted to hit on a couple things. Here's the first one. You'll know if you're a diehard college football fan, Phil Steele is a very well-respected writer who does his magazine, and his predictions are very well-respected and thought of. And he has Georgia and Michigan in the playoff this year. And everybody knows that I don't understand the Michigan love. I just don't understand it. I don't know what it's based in. I just can't understand it. If they win the Big Ten and prove me wrong and beat Ohio State and beat us, I'll be happy to say, wow, Harbaugh finally turned the corner. I just don't see it happening, and that's my opinion. So we'll just see who's right or wrong, okay? But my point with this is, if he's got Georgia and Michigan in the playoff, Notre Dame's got a lot to say about what happens and how this year's going to shape out. So Notre Dame has a terrific opportunity to really change the narrative, win some games people don't think they're going to win that they haven't been winning, and to really turn people's plans upside down here with a lot of these predictions. So it's a good place to be mixed into some of this, because you could really upset the apple cart here and turn these predictions sideways if you go take care of business and win some ball games. And so I'm fine with them not picking Notre Dame to be there. I almost like that position a little better with a chip on our shoulder and something to prove. That's one note. The next note is, did you see that Ohio State is trying to copyright the word "the" because they like to be called the Ohio State University? Like, people say Notre Dame has a lot of arrogance. I can't imagine how arrogant you'd have to be to try and own the phrase "the." Like, this blows my mind. And the only reason I'm not absurdly going off on this is because as long as they keep beating Michigan, I can't hate them that much. You know, I obviously disliked Urban Meyer and the snake he is. But as long as they're beating the hell out of Michigan, that's my out. The enemy of my enemy is my friend type of deal. So if we don't play Ohio State, I would much rather Ohio State win that division and conference over Michigan. So as much as I dislike Ohio State, they're my best friend when it comes to us both hating Michigan. So that's the only reason I'm not railing on them more. But you know, oh, Notre Dame and their arrogance. Well, we're not trying to coin the phrase "duh" and say that it's ours. Okay, that's special right there. You really got to think you are something to try and pull this off. The. You kidding me? Also, here's this note. You guys know I hate BSPN. It's a garbage channel. It's turned to trash. It's all politically given, politically driven, narrative driven, just garbage. The only time I watch ESPN is two things. One, if there's a live game I can only get on ESPN or their networks. Two, the 30 for 30 series, because they let other people direct the shorts, which is terrific. Other than that, I don't watch any of their garbage. That includes Game Day. That show's ruined to me. Desmond Coward is horrible at his job. He's too busy. I can't say what I want to do, what he's doing to Harbaugh, but he refuses to look at things fairly. I can't even watch Game Day. It's garbage, trash. So then Disney and, you know, Disney, the Disney company owns ESPN. Well, they're going to have one of the College Game Day shows live from Disney. Now, doesn't that sound like a great, fun idea? Oh, yeah. It's $100 plus tax to get in, and there's no signs allowed. Think about that. $100 plus tax, and there's no signs allowed. So you just basically ruined College Game Day. For the people that still did watch it, I don't know about you, but the signs are the best part, because what these people say is total garbage. Desmond Howard and Lee Corso's lost his damn mind, okay? So the only redeeming quality was those funny signs, and they're not letting you do it. And I think it's like $133 with tax or some fees to get into this. Total garbage. That channel is going down the shitter. People are finding better ways to get their information. It's not like when I was 12 and all I did in the summer was watch reruns of SportsCenter for 4 hours in a row to get my information. The day has changed and people are moving away from them. It's garbage. Don't watch it. It's filth. Something I've been seeing a lot on Twitter lately, as we're ramping up into college football season rapidly approaching, is all of these lists of, you know, best college programs of all time, you know, this kind of stuff. And everybody's got their different things they put on Twitter. Then everybody freaks out. Somebody feels their program slighted, and then they take exception, and it goes back and forth. Here's how you got to look at these things. One is, there has to be a formula. So that's what I ask when I see some of these, you know, lists of the top 20 programs of all time or whatever. What's your formula? It can't just be your dumb opinion and then your team's number one because that's your opinion. You need to have a formula that's fair with all the components put into it that shoot out a fair ranking for everybody. So that's the first thing you should ask these people before you get all offended or say something smart ass back. I always respond with, please share with me your formula. I need to know how you came to this. You know, national titles, divisions won, All-Americans, you know, Heismans. How are you computing this? So you got to figure out that first before you can have an opinion. And so you got to make sure that formula is fair and it makes sense, and then look at the information given. So you got to do your research too before you just shoot back and you're all mad at them. For leaving Notre Dame out and then leaving Frank Leahy out of some of the best coaches of all time lists, which offends me personally because I love Frank. Another thing that came up again is people, again, I saw a national outlet talking about all the buys of the teams that played Notre Dame, have seven teams have buys before playing Notre Dame this year. I'm on the record of saying buys are definitely good when you need health. So especially later in the year when teams are beat up, there's no way around it. You could use a week to get your health back. That is, I think, undeniably an advantage. However, short of that, I'm not convinced having a bye is always an advantage compared to a team that doesn't. If you're playing good and you got some rhythm going, you want to keep playing. You don't want to have to stop for a half a month. Conversely, you might come out of a bye rusty. You might come out of a bye sloppy because you're out of that routine. So I'm not necessarily convinced and going to freak out that all these byes are automatically going to cost Notre Dame 3 points or a score. I'm just not sold on that. I think it's very situational. And it depends on your season, where you're at in your season, and what's happening. And so I'm not personally going to get freaked out about that. I'm just not. And the other thing is, for us, at least half of those teams that have byes, Notre Dame should beat anyways. So it's not a huge deal. you know, I know Georgia plays a horrible team before us, Arkansas State or some nobody. And then I know Michigan plays at Penn State the week before us. That is about the furthest opposite of a bye as you're going to get for them to go to that environment, then play us, okay? And then I'm pretty sure Stanford plays the week before they play us too. So a lot of those byes that these teams have are the garbage teams on the schedule anyways. So that's my position on byes. I'm not sold it's an automatic negative for Notre Dame. I think it's very situational. Okay, two quick Notre Dame or NFL notes, and then always annoyed, okay? One is with this NFL, they need to cut the preseason down. It can't be four games. This is total garbage football. A guy like Matt Nagy and these younger coaches, they straight up just don't play any starters anymore. Game two for the Bears preseason, none of the starters played. It's just not worth the injury to these guys. It's just not worth it to get a little extra practice in. So four games is too much. What they charge you in your season ticket package, you have to have those pregame tickets. It's just too much. And so the players don't like it either. So what I think is going to happen is in 2 years when the CBA comes up, they're going to figure something out. And it's going to get cut back, I think, to two games. The question is going to be, does that mean that you just have two preseason games, then your regular 16? Or are they going to do the two and then add two regular season games and another bye to the NFL schedule? I don't know how those negotiations are going to go. But I guarantee you, these four games need to be cut. It needs to go to two max. The level of play is total garbage. And it's just not entertaining. Nobody's going to go. I mean, if you're not going to play your starters at all, nobody's going to go. And so that's a bad look for the NFL. And I just don't think this is sustainable. The games change with all the safety concerns. Four games is too much. It's just is. So I expect this to be addressed in 2 years when that CBA comes up for negotiation again. It's just not sustainable anymore, and it's a garbage product. And then this is absolutely astounding to me. Did you see that the NFL has partnered with Roc Nation and Jay-Z for him to kind of be, I don't know what you want to call it, the social awareness guy for the NFL for like diversity, Colin Kaepernick issues, like this kind of social justice thing that the NFL's had problems with their discipline, with how they handled the kneeling and all that kind of stuff. So then they announced that Jay-Z is now going to be involved in that side of the NFL corporate operation. So then Goodell and Jay-Z get up there and they act like this is some big step forward for equality and this is going to change those issues. And now Jay-Z's involved and we're branching out and it's showing. Goodell wants to show how not racist the NFL is by hiring, you know, the black guy that everybody knows and loves. Oh, and everybody knows and loves his wife even more than they know and love him. Okay. This is all total garbage. No one should fall for this act at all. This is actually the opposite effect to me, because what I see this as, Jay-Z's now a cover for the NFL, because now they're not going to take any heat when one of these situations pops up and people say they're not handling it right or it's racist or whatever. Because they're going to say, well, what do you mean? It went through the desk of the popular black guy that everybody likes. How could it be racist? Jay-Z was okay with it. So that's what's happening here. All Jay-Z is a cover of a popular black guy. So now they can deflect any criticism that comes from anything. They can defer to this cover of it passing through Jay-Z. And it's like, well, he's the popular black guy, so what do you mean? If it's okay with him, we're in the clear. So Goodell's not fooling anybody with this. This totally gets him off the hook for any criticism about social justice or Kaepernick or race issues or how they discipline certain guys and not other guys. Jay-Z's now the cover for that. Goodell loves it. This is total, nobody fall for this as a step forward. It's actually a cowardly step backwards. Because all he is a cover now for every move they make. And so I just hope nobody's dumb enough to fall for this and actually look at this as meaningful progress. It's a business deal between the multi-billion dollar NFL and billionaire Jay-Z. That's all this is a business opportunity. But Goodell has his cover now. He's got his boy. So now everything that goes on, he's going to say, well, what do you mean? We didn't do it wrong. It went through Jay-Z. So what are you talking about? If he signed off on it, we're in the clear. It's totally disingenuous. So don't fall for it. All right. You know what time it is. It's time for another edition of Always Annoyed. Now, here's where we're going to go this week. This is something I've never, ever, ever understood. Maybe I'm missing something here. Maybe not. But I don't get it. And I need somebody to explain it to me because it's annoying. Happens once a day wherever I'm at. Somebody explain to me what the deal is with these like used 1997 two-door $3,000 Honda Civics with the most annoying loud exhaust system ever. I don't understand it. Why is that necessary? Now, I'm not talking about a guy pulling up at a stoplight in a 1964 Dodge Charger, souped up muscle car. I understand why you have a loud exhaust, because I understand what's under your hood. That's a real man's muscle car. I'm talking about these guys in these little beat up Honda Civics, and they got the loudest, most annoying thing. You're at a red light and they're revving it up when they're in neutral right next to you. I don't understand that. Why is that necessary? Does that make you feel cool? Does that make you feel like a tough guy? Do you think that's a chick magnet? Like, is that your mating call? Seriously, somebody explain it to me. I don't get it.
Sick, man. Sick.
Oh, totally sick, bro. Cool $3,000 Civic. Now you tell me why you need that in a $3,000 used car. Tell me why you need it. It's annoying. What are you showing off? Like, I don't know what you think this is. Like, is that like your silent mating call dog whistle that like the chicks you think are going to hear you revving your engine in this beat up Civic going down the street and all the girls are just going to like run out of their houses and try and jump in your car and hang out with you? Somebody explain it to me. And it can't, don't tell me, oh, that's a real serious car thing to improve performance. These guys are driving beat up Honda Civics. Come on. Tell me what the practical reason for that is. It's just annoying. It's a social nuisance. Nobody wants to hear that. I don't understand how cool you could possibly feel sitting at a red light, revving your engine, making all that racket. How cool could you possibly feel doing that? Does that make you feel like a real man? Now, maybe I'm missing something because I'm not a car guy. I could change a tire and that's about it. Okay, I'm not one of these motorhead guys. Like, it's just not something I'm interested in. So if there's a reason I don't know why you would do this, other than you think it sounds cool, but it doesn't, explain it to me. because I genuinely don't get it. It's really annoying. Every one of these drivers seems to be like some wannabe tough guy, you know, suburban white kid, and daddy gave him $4,000 to soup up this used two-door Honda Civic from the 90s. And the kid thinks he's freaking Fast and Furious. And you know what else? Here's the other thing I don't understand about this. I've been to certain cities where you could get a ticket if you have those subwoofers in your car and it's considered too loud for the neighborhood. I've been to cities where you can't do that. But it's okay for this guy to just rev up that Honda Civic and wake the whole neighborhood up, and that's fine. But if you're bumping some old school Snoop Dogg, you're getting a ticket for a noise violation. I don't understand it. I think it's just wannabe tough guys. Guys who think they're cooler than they are. They're trying to show off, but they don't have the real money to. So they do this. Like, I'm honestly asking, if I'm missing an angle here, tell me. But it's really annoying when I look over. I'm just like trying to go to work. And I got one of these idiots revving his engine at the red light 2 inches from me in my ear. I don't get it. You're not cool. You don't have a cool car. I'm not talking about a legitimate muscle car from the 60s or 70s. We're not talking about. These are pieces of shit that these wannabe suburban gangsters are like souping up. I don't understand it. It's totally annoying, totally unnecessary. It's the same profile, these wannabe tough guys who think they're cool, and I just don't understand why this would make you think you are. It gives me a headache. So if you could figure it out, let me know, because this one I have no answer to. It's just plain annoying. All right, that's it. I don't have anything else on this topic. I want answers. Somebody give me the answer, because I can't figure it out, other than you're trying to be cool and you're not. Somebody explain what I'm missing, because I don't get it. All right, we'll talk to you next week.